Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Paul Mason from Martin Brevineyards. How are you, Paul?
I'm great, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. You're the winemaker here?
Winemaker.
What we're going to do today, talk a wee bit about Martinborough, a wee bit of history, and also a wee bit about aging Pinot Noirs. You know, does New Zealand Pinot age, and what's the difference of screw versus cork on those older wines? You guys did a vertical a wee while ago, so. But let's find out a wee bit about yourself. You're saying that you still come from Auckland, but you wanted to come to Martin Vineyards. What's the story there?
Yeah, well, first got the Pinot bug back in 95 while I was at university, and went to a tasting, which was actually Larry McKenna, the first winemaker at Martin Vineyard, showing a lot of his Pinots from the early 90s, and really fell in love with Pinot around that time, and always wanted to end up in Martinborough. I always considered this region makes New Zealand's best Pinot Noir, so it made it a goal to end up here, and luckily, 6 years ago, got an assistant winemaker job here, and everything's fallen into place.
Excellent, excellent. But Martinborough's been open for quite a long time. They're one of the first vineyards in the region.
Yeah, the sort of modern-day history of Martinborough dates back to 1980 and the late 70s, where before there were vineyards here, this was mainly just sheep growing and horticultural land, no vineyards. A soil scientist by the name of Derek Milne did a soil survey, knew the region, did a soil survey, and thought this would be ideal for growing grapes. He mapped the climate up against a lot of European grape-growing regions. And from that, he put his money where his mouth is and started Martin Vineyard, along with his brother and sister-in-law and another couple of partners. In the same year, Aotearangi started, and Dry River, and another little winery called Chifney, which no longer exists, but the three of those four are still major players in Martinborough today, and yeah, 30-year anniversary this year, 2010.
So. Oh, very nice.
The main part of what makes Martinborough Martinborough, I guess, is that the where all these vines are and where all the original plantings are is an old river terrace raised up by earthquakes, a very small area, only sort of 4 kilometres long by a kilometre wide, and that's been identified as the sort of the main grape-growing region of Martinborough, and that's those alluvial soils that I think give a lot of the sort of terroir characters to our wines.
Doesn't the soil, or at least the riverbeds, go right through to Masterton and Gladstone?
Slightly different. They do stretch all the way. Gladstone is from the same river, from the Ruamahanga, which runs from the very north of this region right through to the south. Masterton, again, slightly different. Similar but different climates up there as well. Here we're actually on the merge of two rivers rather than the one, so we've got a lot of our soil comes more from the eastern hills than the northern hills, which is important.
You might hear, just as we're having this podcast, a bit of banging noise. What is that?
We're right in the getting close to harvest time now, so the birds are, or the grapes are ripening and the birds are coming. We suffer quite a bit of bird pressure at this time of year, and as those ripe grapes get even riper, the birds start eating them. So we've got a combination of nets on all our vineyards. We've got these gas bangers that there's one just you'll hear every now and then. And all these factors, all these tools we use to try and deter the birds as much as possible.
So just if you hear a bit of noise, that's what's going on. One of the things I really want to talk about is Pinot Noir, because you're a big Pinot producer, aren't you? What sort of grapes do you grow here?
Pinot Noir is the focus of our company and certainly most of Martinborough. For us, that's around 70% of our production. Next, we'd have most of our white varieties, Sauvignon Blanc, be about 15% of our production, and then tiny bits of Chardonnay, Riesling, Pinot Gris. Plus, we've also got a tiny bit of Syrah Viognier, Syrah and Viognier, which we co-ferment together.
You're fairly far south for Syrah. I have seen it grown in Otago, but that's right out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, under a sun lamp. yeah, it's cool. It is cool climate, Syrah. But then I look to France and then a lot of those regions in northern Rhone where they grow some of the best Syrah in the world. They're fairly cool, a lot closer in climate to Burgundy than to the south of the very south of France. So I think it can work, and
Has it? How many vintages you had?
We're on our third vintage now. It's a variety. I think for us, we'll only ripen maybe 3.5 or 4 times out of every 5 vintages. But it's an exciting wine to make. Something I really enjoy. We make it exactly like we make a Pinot, so it's definitely in that cool climate style.
Let's focus in on the Pinots. We had a look at your library. You've got quite a lot of Pinot going back. What was your first vintage?
So the first vintage was 84. Yeah, we've been making it ever since then. So we did a big tasting of all our Pinots in 2005, which was our 25th year anniversary since the first vine was planted, where we looked at every single Pinot we'd made from current vintage right back to the 84, including at the time our 5 reserve Pinots from the 90s, which was a fascinating exercise to do.
How did you find them? Like, is the 84 drinking all right, or is everything aged up nicely, or what's the story? The
84 was drinkable. probably past its best, but interesting. I think we invited a lot of top media to that tasting and did the tasting in Auckland. I think there was probably a preconception back then that New Zealand Pinot aged sort of 3 to 5 years. I think we showed that... from good years and good producers, that quite easily stretch 8 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. The style does change, obviously, as it ages, and it's a matter of appreciating that and change and whether you like that or not. So that was an 05, and certainly for me, one of the best wines of that night was the 89, which was then a 16-year-old wine. So that was still drinking really well.
So what's happening, both in terms of structure and aroma profile, as the wines are aging?
Yeah, so in terms of the aroma, I see a shift. Generally, our wines, when they're young, are quite spicy, aren't more spicy dominated, Asian spices, and a lot of red fruit character in there, the cherries and cranberry sort of type aromas. As that wine evolves, we start moving into the more savoury characters, the more earthy, sort of mushroomy, those forest floor characters, most people associate with old Burgundy as well. I see a lot of those characters in our wine. The tannins certainly become a lot silkier and smoother. And as long as you've got a good tannin base to start with, I think that really helps the ageing potential of the wines.
I noticed Palliser earlier today when I was tasting their wines have quite a lot of firm tannins to it. Haven't had a chance to try your wines, just about to after this, but... Do you build the tannin layer in there, or to
the tannin profile of Martinborough? I think is the key to making, it gives Martinborough its characteristic taste, and I think we get that naturally in our grapes and in our wine, and that is probably a combination of the soil, but also the climate. We've got quite a long growing season here, so we're starting sort of late August and not harvesting till April, so. Whilst in that time frame, it's not exceptionally hot. We're only getting temperatures sort of in the middle of summer of low 30s, high 20s. Mm-hmm. And those characteristics are great for building tannins.
What, instead of the grapes ripening pretty quickly, you're ripening slow?
Yeah, a nice slow ripening period. So rather than getting just tutti frutti simple pinots, you're actually getting more structural pinots. The tannin has enough time to properly develop on the grape.
We grabbed one of the grapes and got to try it. Normally when I get to vineyards, either the grapes have been picked or they're tasting pretty green and horrible little monster berries. The berries were quite small.
Yep.
But you opened them up and you showed me the pip in there. What's going on there as it ripens?
The tannins are building in the pip as it ripens and in the grape. And it's one of the key aspects of my job is to go and taste those, especially the closer we get to harvest, the more I'm tasting. And you're looking at basically the tannins softening with time. Now they're quite bitter and quite hard. The decision to pick will be based on primarily on the ripeness of those pips and how soft and how crunchy they are. And once we believe they're at a right level, then the grapes are essentially physiologically ripe and we'll start picking.
Do you get any tannins from the pips themselves, or does it all come from the skin?
Pinot Noir, from everything I've read, is one of the highest tannins in the pips themselves. So it's very important for us to get, and this is compared to other red varieties.
Yep.
So it's very important for us to get the pips ripe as much as possible.
You talked about how the pip changes colour as it ripens as well.
Yeah, so we tasted the grapes out there, and they still had quite a bit of The grapes themselves are purple and getting riper in colour, but inside, once you peel back the skin, there's still quite the pulp of the grape is still quite green, like a fluorescent green. Mm. As that ripens, that greenness dissipates and leaves a bit more of a clear character, and the pip turns into a darker brown colour, and that's the ripening stages I'm looking for when we're judging when to pick.
What happens if you leave it too long?
It's probably one of the most fickle things about Pinot, that it is. You don't want grapes that are either underripe or overripe. So I think once we get too ripe, we start losing acidity, but also finesse in our grapes. They become a bit jammy and a bit overripe character, which is a bit porty tasting, raisined. So very key for us to get that just right. And quite often that could be a window of less than a week. So.
Okay, so you eat a lot of grapes.
Lots of grapes to be eaten in the next month or so. Yeah.
Do you suffer? I remember when I was a kid and you used to eat big bowls of cherries the next day. It was pretty...
Yeah.
It wasn't pleasant.
Not nice. Yeah, I start building my palate up now by having a few grapes at home, just a few table grapes, just to get your stomach used to the onslaught that's about to happen.
Okay.
Make sure you're never too far from a toilet.
You've decided the grapes are ripe, they're ready to go.
Yep.
How do you sort of extract the tannins from the pips or from the skin? You know, is it just a long, cold soak?
We're very, what I would always used to consider traditional winemaking. Mm-hmm. After being in Burgundy a few times, I've realised that's different things to different people. But we're very hands-off in our winemaking. We'll do all hand harvesting for our grapes. Go through, once they come into the winery, they go into a sorting table. We generally take most of the stems away. We do some whole bunch in our fermentations. But they'll just go into the tank. They'll sit in the tank. We're big on natural, wild or uninoculated ferments here. Yeah, we're big into that. Really, really keen on that with our Pinot.
I've had Martinborough wines in the past, and I've never noticed those funky flavours you get from Germany. You know, you get a wild ferment from Mosel and... don't quite know what's going to come out of that.
Yeah, you hear those things when you go out and taste, and maybe you taste the odd wine, but I've never noticed that in our wines. Yeah. I've noticed more consistent fermentations.
Is that because maybe the yeast, because it's such a young wine region, the yeast that is wild is just inoculated yeast that's got out?
I don't know. I'm happy with the character it provides in our wines. I can't say scientifically where it comes from, but...
Yeah.
One thing we have noticed in the last sort of 3 to 4 years, as we've moved into organic vineyard management, is a lot cleaner and a lot healthier ferments, mm-hmm. which is good to see. And that's we do have a couple of contract growers that have different vineyard management, and we do see differences in the natural ferment rates and developments of those wines, so it's quite interesting. In total, we'd do about 3 weeks fermentation, sort of a week of pre-fermentation at an ambient temperature of whatever that is at a harvest, normally around 15.
Cold soak.
Yeah, we're not cold, we're cool though. Yeah, we won't apply the refrigeration and cool it down to minus whatever or into the low, the 1, 2, 3, 4 degrees to stop fermentation. I want to encourage the yeast that are there on the skin, so we'll leave it at 15, 16. That will generally take 4, 5, 6 days to start ferment by itself.
Yep.
And then build up to a nice temperature of sort of 33, 34 degrees in the size fermenters that we have. Then the next step for us, once the ferment's finished, so that's probably at the 2 week phase, is we leave it for another week to 10 days on skins, which is, to me, is essential to building the tannin profile and development.
Not just the skin, so the seeds as well?
Yep.
And what about any sort of stem matter?
Yeah, all in there, all in there. And what we're doing at that point is tasting it every day. We're still plunging the tank once a day, whereas in the ferment, in the heated ferment, we'll probably 3 times a day. Uh-huh. But once it's finished ferment, we're just back to once a day.
Yeah. Is that because the gas isn't pushing the head up?
I don't want to extract too much at that point. I think all our major part of our extraction is done. And it's just the fine-tuning. And from that sort of post-fermentation extraction, I see a lot more mid and back palate tannins evolving in the wine, and that's key to the overall structure of our wines. The 3 to 4 week, 3 week, 21 day, 22 days seems to be about right for us.
You get your wine... Aging-wise, we were just touching on it earlier, we sort of got a bit sidetracked and masterclass on tannins. Because I think the reason we got there is because you're saying that the tannins are quite an important structural element for Martinborough. Do you see a difference between, say, the way the wine evolves regarding tannins? Because when tannins age, they're clumping together and forming bigger chains and softening up and becoming more round. But there's also a possible oxidation that comes through the cork. Do you see a difference maybe between that and stelve enclosures?
We've done trials with screw cap back to 2002, 2003 with both our Pinot and Chardonnay and have been more than happy with the tannin development under screw cap. We see that. We do the blind tastings. We try and do it once or twice a year with those wines that we've kept under both, and that's the 2002 and 3, both under screw cap and cork, same wine, and we'll do a blind tasting of those. Often line three of each up, and only one person in the room knows, not me. And from those tastings, what I see is the first and foremost is that cork is always the worst wine for us of those six. There'll always be some fault with that, with one of those six, and that'll be the cork one, one of the cork ones. The next thing I see often
just is... Just on faults here, because some faults that new world producers say are faults, the old world say are great, they're character-developing flavours. So a fault to one person isn't necessarily a fault for everybody.
Yeah, I could understand that, but these are what I would consider faults. They're not open to interpretation. You know, if there's five of us in the room, all five of us will agree that's a fault. It's oxidation more than enough to age the wine, or it's TCA, or it's major scalping of flavours. Yeah, so it's not interpretations on terroir or anything like that. So that's and the other thing with those tastes, quite often I won't be able to tell which one's a cork and which one's a screw cap. And quite often, if we've got two top wines, one might be cork and one might be screw cap. So I don't think screw cap is the absolute perfect closure, but it's certainly for us a better alternative than cork. And so that's why we switched in 2006.
Are you open? Have you looked at any other closures?
No, we haven't. We looked at the DM cork, which is the composite cork. We did look at that for a while. I don't really have anything bad to say about DM. They seem quite fine, but I mean, I know now when I go out to buy a bottle of wine, if I've got the choice of two wines, one in a screw cap, one in a cork, I'll buy the one in a screw cap. I'm just not going to take the risk.
Apart from the tannins and maybe a bit of oxidation, what about the flavour profile or flavour changes between maybe screw cap and versus cork for you guys?
Haven't really seen too much. I was in those tastings where we do, and I can't tell which is screw cap, which is cork. That sort of, to me, suggests that they're doing a similar job in their aging.
Even though there's less oxygen getting in for the screw cap.
My first degree was in science at Auckland University, and one of the things, the main things I learned from that was that science can prove or disprove anything.
It's like statistics.
Yeah, it's like statistics, exactly the same. And so you'll read some reports that say you need oxygen to age wine. Other scientific papers will say you don't need oxygen to age wine. So all I know is what works for us is what works for us, and I'm happy to go along with it. You know, in 10 years' time, if these wines we're bottling under screw cap for some reason aren't aging that well, then we'll look at other alternatives. So the moment we're happy, that's, you do what's part of the job is you do what you think is best.
Okay, just one last thing on your biodynamics. You're talking a wee bit about not being biodynamic, but what would you say you're doing?
Biological management at the moment, which is related to biodynamics, uses a few of the biodynamic preparations, but similar philosophy basically. Rather than burying cow pits and horns of cow manure, we're buying in these preparations that are all designed, and this is very similar to biodynamics, and terms of getting the soil as healthy as possible, getting the microbe life up, the fungi in the soils, making sure the soils are ecologically healthy. And with that healthy soils, we should get healthy vines and therefore vines that produce better fruit. It's something, it's still in the early stages of it. I think, you know, we've only been doing it for 3 or 4 years now. I think it'd be interesting to see in another 5 years' time what it's at. But certainly the vineyard soil looks a lot healthier, and when we dig holes around You can certainly see a lot more life in there. There's not as many weeds as what there once was, a lot more grass growing. So all positive
things
so far.
Do you think you can taste the difference in the wine, or do you think it's all about just vineyard management?
Maybe one day I think we will. I know people talk about that. It's hard to say because we've sort of done the wholesale conversion, all our vineyards over to that. So I think the wines will be better as a result. Whether they'll be different, I don't know. It's still in the same. Should express more of the terroir in theory, and all the vines are still in the same spot and subject to the same climatic variations. So
okay,
we'll see.
All right, mate. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.